Welcome to episode number 257. That's a lot. 257, and we are here with Matt Saman, a fellow podcaster himself, Jamoti Podcast. He is here. He is also a highly successful high school boys basketball coach out of Grapevine Faith High School in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Really excited to talk to Coach here today. But before we get to Coach, we, of course, have to thank our founding sponsor, Cosac Chiropractic, located at 144th and Maple here in Omaha. Coaches, if you or any of your athletes are struggling with balance, neck, or spinal issues, have them go see Cosac Chiropractic. Check out their practice at Cosac Chiro, KOSACHIRO.com. Follow us on Twitter at a pen and a napkin. We try to put out daily coaching tidbits on the Twitter handle, so be sure to follow us there. Just did that about 20 minutes ago, actually. So like this, review it, subscribe, 5 stars, say nice things. If you're listening, it's Spotify, iTunes, wherever it may be, whatever the platform is, say nice things about a pen and a napkin. And while you're at it, say nice things about Jamoti. We're going to help out our fellow podcasters here. Help us out here. Questions, comments, suggestions, or ideas, email me apenandanapkin@gmail.com. Enough of that stuff here. Coach Saman, how are you doing this fine Monday? I think it's a Monday afternoon. We're not that far into break that we've lost track of what day of the week it is yet. So how are you doing this Monday, my friend?
Coach, I am good, and thank you so much for having me on here. Congrats on 257. That is incredible, man.
Yeah, they haven't taken me off the airwaves yet. So, you know, and hopefully after the next hour or so, which I think we're going to be pretty safe. We're both, as we say here on a pen and a napkin, we're seasoned and experienced at this. So I think we know what we're doing. You know, Matt, it's great to have you on here. We're going to talk a little bit about your pod at some point and just kind of maybe exchange some notes on the air here. We'll see where we go with it. But before we get to that, Coach, for those that don't know about you, don't know about your particular story, tell us about yourself. Tell us about your basketball journey.
Yeah, thank you for that, for the opportunity to do that. I grew up in Pennsylvania and in a small town called Berwick, PA, about 2 hours north of Philly. Loved basketball, but believe it or not, even up there in Pennsylvania, it was a football town. And I had this passion, love for the game that I noticed early on, probably fourth or fifth grade, a lot of my friends didn't have. And even though I played a lot of different sports, basketball was different, and just loved getting to work on skills. Pistol Pete's Homework Basketball was a big influence on me. Mm-hmm. And from so my love for drills and skill work, and was very fortunate to have a coach that had started coaching me when I was little in YMCA basketball, moved down to the Colony, Texas, while I was still in junior high. And I would come visit him, and right before my senior year in high school, flew down to go to a basketball camp, and I met a guy named Tommy Thomas. He was the head basketball coach at the Colony High School. Mm-hmm. And I told him what my goals were, and which the final one was to play Division I basketball. And I think maybe looking back, that was probably, if I would have liked some guidance on, hey, college basketball is a great goal, but widen your view to all types of levels and really focus on fit. I had, for whatever reason at that time, I had Division I as the goal. And So on my way back home from camp, on the, you know, driving from the airport back to Berwick, I told my parents that I needed to move to the Colony, Texas to play basketball, and so I could be a Division I basketball player. And 2 weeks later, they flew me down to start high school at the Colony as a freshman. So my family was all in on this dream and what my goals were. And it did end up being happening the way I wanted. And I thought that at some point I'd grown up in a Christian home. Mm-hmm. And I thought that God was right along with the vision that I had, and he was going to make it happen the way that I wanted, as long as I was a good person and continued to go to church, and almost kind of like a genie. And I think that's what faith happens. It turns for a lot of people into that. And was able to play at Baylor, and then going into my senior year, played it 3 years for Dave Bliss, every game. Going into my senior year, everything fell apart. Scott Drew came in, and it was a pretty interesting senior year. I'll kind of let you take it from there.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did you end up at? Let's take it step by step here. You go to Baylor. At the time, a solid program, wouldn't call it a great program, but, you know, right on, kind of a bubble program between the NIT and the NCAAs, you know, and Coach Bliss had coached with Bobby Knight, had a couple stops along the way, SMU before then. Obviously, you went through, you were in the middle of the tornado of the hurricane in times 10 with everything that happened down there at Baylor. You had a teammate murder another teammate, and you know everything that happened as a result with that. And we don't need to dig through that too much, Matt, but you took that because everybody knows. I mean, if you it doesn't take much to know the story. What was really interesting about you and what you decided to do is you eventually took your experience through all of this chaos, and you wrote a book about it called The Leftovers. And it's a terrific book. I read it about a year ago, probably. And you know, just tell us a little bit about that process of taking your college experience and taking this, you know, like I said, we'll just call it the hurricane that came about there between your junior and senior year that summertime, and how you took this tragedy. And for you, I think it was probably a little bit of a therapy situation, kind of moving your way through it. And just how did you go through that process?
Yeah, definitely. And thank you for kind of giving me a little more direction there, because I'm always worried. I get to share my testimony quite a bit. So that whole story, the summer leading up to it and things that happened after, it could be a 30, 40 minute talk, or I can go for 5 minutes. So thank you for that. And yeah, but Dave, you're right on the money. Dave Bliss was known as the program builder. You know, he had done it at Oklahoma, he had done it at SMU, then at New Mexico, and he was coming to Baylor at a time where it wasn't very good. I tell people all the time, the Baylor that I went to is not the Baylor of today. Yeah. And so I have a lot more street cred now for saying that I played at Baylor than at that time. But Dave Bliss did a really good job of selling me, one of my other teammates from Select Ball, Logan Kozmulski, as being pillars of that program. I mean, everybody wants to be a part of something special and feel like they're building or a part of a legacy, or, you know, part of a legacy. And so that's what we felt like. And we did make the NIT my freshman year and had some really good young players join us. And we were building something, all this momentum, to where my senior year, we thought we were going to be in the top 25, probably top four in the Big 12. Mm-hmm. And that means making deep runs in the NCAA tournament, which is ultimately the goal, I think, for most college players. Sure. Is to get the play there. But then, man, that summer, everything was ripped apart. And you mentioned it, what happened with one of my teammates. But then the coaching staff that I had played for found out that they were doing a lot of things wrong right in front of me. And so this perfect scenario that I've been a part of was just completely shattered. And Coach Drew came in as a 32-year-old. We had 6 scholarship players to play a full Big 12 schedule. I don't think there's really ever been anything like it. And we were struggling early on. I was a leader that was faking it and wasn't really bringing my very, very best. But Coach Drew and his staff were trying to do their best to keep us showing up every day and trying to be competitive. And there is something really powerful that happened during that year, mm-hmm. where we started to buy in to our coaching staff, believe in each other, and you've heard of this before, but the most dangerous team is the one that has nothing to lose, that doesn't fear losing.
Yep.
And we were that team. So our goal was to just go out and let's see what we can do against their 5. And we were competitive against Kansas, you know, down 4 with 10 minutes left. We beat A&M twice. We beat Iowa State. We were up at Oklahoma by 14 in the first half, but then we were up 4 at Texas Tech, where Bobby Knight was. So it's like, were competitive, but most games were the same. We would just get tired because I was playing 38 minutes a game, and I wasn't built for that. I could give you 20 really good minutes. And so, but at that season ended, and at the time, I was in a very bad place, frustrated with basketball, thought that the deal that God and I had, he wasn't keeping up his end of the bargain. So I took control of my happiness as a 21-year-old, and that's a dangerous thing to do. And I really took this path. I played in Iceland for 1 year, but was playing good basketball, was asked to leave because of my off-court habits, and came back home very lost. And it took a few years for me to find my calling, which was coaching basketball. I never really thought of coaching, even though a lot of my coaches had told me that I would or should do that at some point. I was a player, but I found coaching. But even through that, it was about a 9-year journey of just being frustrated and not being a very good person in general to most people. But I was coaching at the time and learning kind of who I was or what style of play at least I liked, but definitely more transactional, not worrying about culture and not worrying about what I was doing in the lives of players. It was more about what skill can I give them and how can that translate to the floor. And then, like you said, when I was 30 years old, God did change my life and brought my wife, who was a catalyst for that change, into my life. Opened up a door for me to be able to come to Grapevine Faith Christian School. But in that time, I started writing the story of The Leftovers. And I would encourage anybody, whether it's a book or not, to get your story down on paper. Because when I started it, it was really because I had read this book called The Walk-On, Life at the End of the Bench by Alan Williams, which I think years later he rebranded it as Teammates Matter. Mm-hmm. But I read that book and I thought, this is my story as a player, except I wasn't a walk-on, I was a scholarship, but 39 different teammates came in and out of the door over four years at Baylor. And somehow I remained as a 6'2¾" non-athletic guy that averaged 4.5 points a game and would dive on the floor and take charges and was a great teammate. So what does that story look like? How could a normal person who's not 6'8½" and just gifted make it to that level and survive in the locker room with coaches? And so that was the first part of the book. And then it was, okay, not just get to college, but how do you make it through every year your scholarship is up for grabs?
Yeah.
And they're trying to over-recruit. Like John Lucas came in as a freshman, I was a sophomore, and was instantly better than me. And I had to compete or find a new role with him. And then I got to the part where, oh, wow, like I hadn't thought about what had happened that senior year. Even though my first practice in Iceland, they asked me where I played, and I told them Baylor. And in broken English, they said, don't they murder people there?
Oh, geez.
So like that story that I was a part of followed me all the way over to Iceland. And so I started to get into that. And this is where I feel like everybody should do it, is I really got to see where life took a turn and how the decisions I had made. And when I went into church went in to talk to a pastor as a 30-year-old, really angry and just wanting to vent to him. And I told him the story, just kind of like I've done here. He said, Matt, it's your fault. And I was like, no, listen, I was a good kid and I didn't do any of that stuff. He's like, but no, you took control of your happiness at 21. And he asked me, how's that going for you? And I just dropped my head and I said, you know what? I'm not very good at controlling things in my life and I need to give it back. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't have seen that or known that. And then it's really cool. Now I can see how God's hand has still been on my life over the years through that. And the truth is, if I'm not at rock bottom, I don't go to that church randomly and fill out a visitor's card. That visitor's card led me to be contacted by a lady named Jana, who just got me a meeting with that pastor But I ended up marrying her 11 months later, and life has been drastically different. Yeah. And so I would encourage everybody to put their story down. Maybe it's not because you had a college scandal that you're a part of, but man, how did you get to where you are? And I'd be shocked if you're not changed, or if you don't see a pattern or a plan through all of it.
As a coach now, and you had talked about it, you know, Matt, from about age 21 or 22 to about the age of 30, it was a rough road for you. But if you make it through those tough times, there's a lot there that you can take and teach to your players and the people that are around you. What are two or three things that you take from your 20s when you were going through this really tough stretch of your life personally that you use to help coach your teams today?
Oh, great question. The first thing, it's more like a wish I would have done this list than I actually did this list. But I wish I would have asked the question, what can I learn from this? Because when that when it first happened and we learned that Patrick was missing, and then they thought it's a homicide, and then we found out that our coaching staff, maybe they knew more than we thought, and that they were doing things wrong and that they were going to leave, I never asked the question, okay, you know, Lord, or even if someone's not, doesn't have a faith background, this is hard, I'm struggling through this, but what can I learn through it? Like how can I become better? What do I need to take from this? And I didn't do that. So with players now, because, you know, I've been at places like McKinney High School where, you know, some of these kids are going through hard things with their family. You know, I had a player one time that was living out of his car. You know, basketball wasn't the main thing to him. And so what can I learn through this? I would encourage everybody to kind of examine their faith through those moments. And then, but even at Grapevine Faith Christian School, there's life is hard anywhere you go. So when we lose family members, when we fail a test or an ineligible, you know, what can I learn through this? And instead of getting angry in those moments and resent, and the bigger danger is we start to develop habits that actually take us farther away from where we want to go. And so that would be one of the big things they took from it, is asking that question. And then what can I learn from it? Changes to how can I be a light in this situation? I wish I would have led better back in that, because this comes from one of my conversations I've been able to have with coaches over the years, is instead of faking it when bad things happen, and that's what I did, is I started faking it in a big way. I was giving false effort on the floor. I was barely being a positive leader, but I think they were thankful for what I was bringing because it was such a hard time. But golly, it was so much wasted opportunities for me, with my teammates, with that coaching staff, with the Baylor community. I wish I would have been more of a light, but instead of faking it, I wish I would have faced it. And I think that's a big one, because like the fake it till you make it saying is harmful and it's dangerous, and it's teaching our players to give less than their best and to develop a pattern of not being real or authentic. So instead of that, let's face it. This is hard. What I'm going through right now, I'm not happy with basketball. I'm not happy with the team. I'm not happy with God. I'm not happy with this, but this is where I am. And we're going to figure out a way to still be a light. I think those are some things that I've now taken from that environment. And then probably on the bigger, you know, with coaching, it's, and PGC really helped with this. I would say God put two big groups or people in my life. One is my wife, and then me getting back in with PGC and Mono and TJ Rosine and Sam Allen and all those guys, and learning really how to be more transformational than transactional. Because you start off, especially as a young coach, I think being so focused on the X's and O's and that being the most important thing. And then maybe you win enough and you realize, golly, this is empty, or you lose and you realize there's got to be more than this. And it's about being transformational and helping these young guys grow.
Mm-hmm. Coaches, by now you have seen the newest thing coming out of a pen and a napkin, the opening tip, Substack newsletter. I put an edition out there for free, and hopefully you see what a great investment this is going to be for you as a coach. I'm guessing it probably is, if you watch everything and listen to everything, it's going to take you almost 3 hours to get through everything on the opening tip newsletter here. What do we have in there? You've got an original article by myself here, just thoughts, ideas on different coaching topics. Into the Lab, that's probably my favorite thing, is the Into the Lab. It's me, another coach, and a whiteboard, and we're just drawing stuff up here. Stuff to help you out, to help you become better, and to help your team become better this coming season and beyond. Got another exclusive podcast. You heard the first one, Industriousness from the Wooden Pyramid of Success, and it's me and it's two semi-retired former girls basketball coaches, Matt Kern of York, Nebraska, Nate Wall of David City Aquinas here in Nebraska. And every newsletter, we're going to break down an aspect of Wooden's Pyramid of Success. Bookshelf recommendations from Off the Bookshelf, X's and O's stuff. I'm dropping in a university video. It's just going to be given to you there, you know, and I really believe in the products that I've put together. It's practical stuff that's going to help make you a better coach. And then we've got the Coach's Corner with links to clips and articles. As you saw, we had our two Olympic coaches, Steve Kerr and Cheryl Reeve. Just really, really good stuff here. And I know it's subscription-based, but goodness gracious sakes alive, as Coach Wooden would say, it is so affordable. $8 a month for two newsletters. That's $4 every newsletter. That's $2 every single week. Or you can get a year-long subscription, $75. That's 24 editions of the newsletter. That's basically $3 a newsletter. That's basically a dollar an hour if it takes you about 3 hours to get through everything that you're getting here. It could not be more affordable. It could not be more positive for you. It's going to help make you a better coach. So subscribe to the Opening Tip newsletter. Folks, you're not going to regret it. You, like you said, Coach Bliss, and again, this is a well-known story. Coach Bliss was, of course, replaced by Scott Drew. At the time, Coach Drew was just the son of the other Coach Drew that was much more well-known than him.
Yeah.
But obviously, he's turned out to be okay for himself here. He's done a few good things there at Waco. What was it like playing for Coach Drew?
Yeah, it was night and day from what I had before. And, you know, sometimes you watch coaches and you see how they talk to their players or how negative they are throughout there. And you kind of make this thought of like, why do guys want to play for that? Like, how is that? And I think then when you're thinking that, then you got to quickly turn around and make sure that you're not doing those things. Like, a great question is like, would you want to play for yourself? But I loved playing for Dave Bliss. He was tough on us. He was not very uplifting, but like it was all business, no relationship for the most part. But if you do that for a while, you start to think that this is the way, and you like it. And so Coach Drew comes in, and he's all smiles, and he wants to hug, and he says he loves us. And he's talking about joy and joy in the future, joy in the process, and how we listen to music during practice. It just didn't seem like this isn't serious. We're about to go up against Texas, Texas Tech, Oklahoma, Oklahoma State, Hall of Fame coaches, Kansas. They have all Americans. We have average players. And I just couldn't get on board. And I didn't think it was authentic. But that was all me and my fault. And years after I left Baylor, and I hadn't been back on campus for about 3 years. I came back to watch a game, but it was very like I almost kind of snuck in and felt like nobody really wanted me there as this dark chapter that I'm sure they wanted to get past. But man, he saw me from across the way and came over after the game, straight line at me, and gave me the biggest bear hug. And it was like, I felt like I've been one of his players for 4 years, not just for 1 year. And he's done that ever since then. He has this group text of veteran players. He sends us texts randomly. Anytime I've contacted him, he responds. Anytime I go down there, he makes it a big deal. Like, and it's this lesson that I've learned from him about our former players, that whether they played 1 year, they were a 1,000-point scorer, or they barely played, they are a huge part of us. And, you know, there's this Immortal 10 statue down on the Baylor campus, and it's the Immortal 10. There's this team in the 30s that there's this tragic bus crash, and they all died. And they have this Immortal 10 statue of the players, and it says, "For they are the we of us." And I'll always love that, because our former players are, when they talk about the we and of who we are, they are the we of us. And so I have that over one of our record boards, and our English teacher, Faith, hates it, because she looks at that. She's like, "That's horrible grammar. That is just a terrible statement." And she always says, like, "What does that even mean?" And I have to go through this whole story. But Coach Drew gets it. And so when they won the national championship and they were having the parade, he contacted players from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, all the way up, and invited all of us to be a part of the parade. And I'm there, you know, with some of the leftovers, but some of Dave Bliss's crew. Mm-hmm. We were all there together, but it wasn't, "This is Coach Drew's thing. This is the Baylor basketball program." And I don't know if I've done the best job at Faith to engage with those earlier Faith guys that before I got here, but the last 12 years, I've kept in mind what Coach Drew has done, and making sure that they always know, with alumni games, kind of some other things, that "For they are the we of us." I think that's good for us to all to pick up from them.
Mm-hmm. What was that like? You know, you obviously at the end of your career, you know, your last year, it was this season that was supposed to be, you know, had high expectations, and it turned out to be the complete opposite of that. But how much pride did you have in your role, in your you know, everything that you went through? It just had to be, your chest had to be puffing out when they knocked off Gonzaga in that national championship game.
Yeah, I had a few moments over the years where it's kind of funny. What Coach Bliss said was true, where he told me I was going to be a pillar of the program. I just thought it'd be in a very different way. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe of us winning and making a deep run, kind of like that, you know, maybe having a team photo that they hang up in because of all the amazing accomplishments we had. But we were 8-21 my senior year, but we were more competitive than anybody else said. And so what Coach Drew said was true, that we were building a foundation for the future, for future Baylor Bears success. I didn't want to hear that at the time, and I didn't think anybody cared in the moment. And so I left there thinking that, well, that's over, on to other things. When they made the NCAA tournament for the first time, 5 years, only 5 years after I left, that was a pretty cool moment. And wow. I got pretty teary and emotional watching them celebrate as nobody could believe that they were already making it there. And then the last 15 years, they've made incredible runs to the Elite Eight, Sweet 16s. They've been in the top 25. They've been ranked number one before. But watching that championship game in my living room, holding my wife's hand through especially the last 5-10 minutes of the game, because they were up 20 at half, and I had such this dread in my heart, like, Gonzaga is going to make a run, and we're going to be looking over our shoulder. But then they were trying to make a run, and we just kept fighting them off, and we kept this lead. And then about 5 minutes left, I just let myself start to think, we're going to do this. Mm-hmm. You know, there were so many moments when I realized it was worth it. Mm-hmm. Kind of going back to why you should write down your story about how you got here as a coach, how you got here as a person, because you start to see like how those moments of adversity, how they were so worth it. And I think every season is kind of like that. Mm-hmm. Whether you win a lot or you lose a lot, so many moments that where you can be validated and, like you said, kind of pump up your chest.
Yep. If how would folks find your book?
A great way is to go just on Amazon. I had self-published it about 12, 13 years ago. And then after they won it, Whitaker Publishing, a Christian publisher, came to me and said they wanted to republish it, which is a really cool thing to go through that process. But Amazon's the best way.
Mm-hmm. Another cool thing that you do, Matt, and is, you know, we're both authors. I know I'm a very amateur author. I could tell you that. But nonetheless, I have words
it's
out there.
In public, man.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we are also both we're podcasters and we're doing stuff to try and help other coaches get better. I know how I came about mine. What drove you to put together the Jamoti podcast? Where'd you get the name from? What was your inspiration to put it all together?
There's a few things in my life that I never thought I would do. One is write a book. If you would ask my English teachers in high school, they would have said, no way does that dude write a book. And then I also never thought I'd do podcasting. Mm-hmm. It's just not something that was ever on my radar. I loved listening to them and learning from them, but I was a coach and I was just completely in that world. And it was COVID. And I think like all of us were bored. You know, during that, we had so much time on our hands.
Sure.
And I had a girls coach reach out to me who just wanted to talk shooting because that's something I've become really passionate about over the years. Our team really values the 3-point shot and our training and how we think about shooting. And so she wanted to talk about it and we were going through that. But then the conversation changed to some of the culture things that she was doing with her team. I remember thinking, man, that's really cool what she does with her. She does a retreat and she had some unique questions. And I thought if we hadn't been on this call talking about shooting, I would have never have known that about her. And most likely in Texas, especially unless you win state, you're never going to be asked to talk at TABC clinic. And most of the coaches out there do amazing things, but there's never a platform from them. Everybody wants to hear the D1 coaches,
yep.
You know, or college coaches, or those coaches that have an incredible amount of wins. And those guys are all fun to talk to. But I love getting to hear from the coaches that, again, you most likely would have never heard from.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the motivation. And then another thing was at PGC, I directed for them for 5 years at their point guard college sessions. And so about 25 of those camps, my favorite part was at night, we would do a debrief with the observing coaches. We'd get together in a circle and we'd talk about what's something you really like today? What's something that you're going to borrow? What are some things that you do back home that you think you can enhance based on what you've learned here? And those talks, like in our notes as directors, it was supposed to be 5 to 10 minutes. And they would go for 2 or 3 hours at times.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just I got so wrapped up in like the community of coaches. Being in a private school, I lost some of that because the public school world, it is a brotherhood or sisterhood of coaches.
Mm-hmm.
Private school, we're kind of out there on an island. A lot of the guys are part-time. It's just not the same. And so this is a way for me to get professional development that I want, to get those people in a, you know, an hour long or so talk of, they're going to answer the questions that I really want to know from them.
Mm-hmm.
And then ultimately getting to give back to the game. Like I've been on a team since I was 9 years old in some way. And so this game has been so good to me and to get to give back to it. I never dreamt that I would be in the 200s episodes, or that people would actually care to listen or want to be on it like yourself. And so it's been amazing. Oh, Jamoti, sorry, Jamoti.
Jamoti, yep.
When I was at camp, I was a camp junkie in junior high and elementary school. And when kids would just have fun during the summers, I would go to six or seven camps all over the country. My parents would drive me there. So I was at Duke basketball camp, and we were doing ball handling lines, and a coach would teach us a new drill, and he would say, "Guys, don't worry, it's Jamoti. Keep going, it's Jamoti." And finally, the kid asked coach, "What is that word? Like, what are you saying?" And he said, "It's Jamoti. It's just a matter of doing it." And I loved that idea of me improving. It's just a matter of doing it. It's just a matter of putting in the work. When you're tired, when you don't want to do it anymore, it's just a matter of continuing to show up. So I took that word from that day, and I made it my personal mantra. So I had Jamoti's workout that every time I learned a new drill, I put it in there, and it was ball handling, two ball dribbling, shooting, passing. And Jamoti grew over the years to where I had to break it up. So I had Jamoti one, two, and three, and so that it wouldn't take hours and hours to do every day. And I put that workout down on a DVD that for my little sister, when I went out to college, my dad filmed me doing it. And so her and her friends would have it. But then when I started coaching, Jamoti was this idea that like, how do we want to improve as a team? It's Jamoti. But then I realized, especially, around age 30, that it's not just Jamoti, just a matter of doing it. There's more to it, because if that was the case, then everybody would get what they want. But that's not how life works. And so each of those letters took on a different meaning. And I've just used that over the years. We don't necessarily use that as a culture right now at faith, because I'm in this realm of or idea of kind of getting away from acronyms, but I still love the idea of Jamoti.
What's kind of the craziest thing that's happened in your podcasting career?
I think the crazy thing for me, I don't know if I have one moment. The crazy thing is when I get on with a person and they say that they enjoy listening. I always think like, wow, are you, I always, I mean, I want to ask, are you serious? Or are you just saying that to be nice? Like you say that to everybody anytime you're on one. Cause I mean, I don't get to, asked to get on, a ton of these or do anything like this. And so, but I think that's the biggest thing. I don't know. What I probably learned the most is, and I've told a few people this, is how little I know. I think I was a pretty arrogant coach early on, thinking that because of maybe who I learned from, Tommy Thomas, Dave Bliss, Doc Drew, and the head coaches I started working for. Oh, he's still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay.
Yeah.
My phone lit up like I lost you. So, yeah, the coaches that I had learned from, and the skill and the player, like I just thought I had all the answers. So I've learned that. And then I've also learned that there are so many ways to do it. I like to run and gun, but that's not the only way to do it. And I think that's kind of, I've gained more humility from doing the podcast.
I think for me, the blessing has just been like I said, the educational part, how much I've learned and been able to take when I was coaching, just how much I was able to apply to that, how much I could take and like, oh, this is going to help my program. Not only am I trying to help other people, but yeah, I'm only gonna keep this for myself. And I don't have enough fingers and toes to show all the things that I took from people who I invite on the podcast. Then, oh yeah, the next thing you know, we're doing this in practice next week, or whatever it may be. So that's definitely the thing that I took from mine, or that I have taken from mine, you know. So
yeah,
agree with you. At what point did you know that you were on to, like, what guest, what situation did you know that, you know, this is becoming something?
Man, that's a great question.
That's why they pay me the big bucks, Matt.
I can't remember a moment, but these are the, what I love really getting to do from that is when either through social media or through email, somebody responds or reaches out to me that they listened to an episode and they really appreciated something that was said by me or the guest, and they want to connect and because they have questions. And an example of this was last year. It was a young coach, middle school coach from Arkansas, just starting out, said he had heard something and wanted to go a little bit deeper and asked if I had time. And thankfully, because of my role at Faith, I do have a lot of time throughout the day. But I remember thinking, like, this is why I'm doing the podcast. Yeah. It's not to get a lot of views or even have just an incredible, like Kelvin Sampson or some of these incredible guests that I've been blessed to have on. It's so that if this junior high coach from Arkansas that's 24 years old and just starting out has questions, that he can reach out to me and I'm approachable and I'm going to make time, because it ended up being like a 45 minute conversation that, I have to remember over, like, hopefully the more and more years I get to do this, to always respond and to always make time.
Yeah.
Because, like, what if, like, we're all in this, and I think hopefully for the most part, for affecting the lives of our players in a positive way. You might start out because you want to win championships or get a certain amount of wins or have a legacy that's known for something. But then hopefully what happened to me happens to everybody is you forget about those things. They become so unimportant because you realize the coaches that you looked up to that aren't coaching anymore, nobody cares.
Yeah.
Nobody cares about the state championships or the amount of wins or what they did. But I care the fact that my high school coach and I still talk. Mm-hmm. I care that he texts me and tells me he's proud of me to this day. So I want to be able to help that coach so he is that way for those players. I think that's probably those moments that I've really appreciated from the podcast. Mm-hmm.
As we enter into this holiday season, coaches, you know what would make a great gift for you this year? It would be a copy of Kings of Their Court, the story of the 2020-2021 season here in Omaha, three ranked teams in the top 25 in the country. And you're going to hear the personal and professional stories of players like Hunter Salas and Chucky Hepburn, Frankie Fiddler, William Kyle, coaches like Tim Cannon, Josh Ludke, and Doug Woodard. Yeah, just a terrific, terrific story, a crazy time period in our country with quarantine, politics, George Floyd, and everything in between. Yours for only $19.99. Go to Amazon, go to books, look up Kings of Their Court, and order a copy of that today. It's going to be a great stocking stuffer for you, for somebody that you love. Tell your wife, tell your spouse, tell your kids, hey, I would love to have a copy of this book and have something to read here and to just read about a great basketball story. Kings of Their Court, available on Amazon.com today. Matt, at this time, we're going to switch gears a little bit. We're going to talk a little John Wooden, if that's all right with you.
Love it.
All right. Each week we have the John Wooden quote of the day from Wooden, A Lifetime of Observations. Coach Saman, are you ready for the John Wooden quote of the day?
I'm ready.
All right. From page 13, early in the book. The John Wooden quote of the day is, "Someone is not a good friend because he or she does good things for you all the time. It's friendship when you do good things for each other. It's showing concern and consideration. Friendship is so valuable and so powerful. We take it for granted, but we shouldn't."
It's good. It's good. It makes me think a lot about, he says friendship, but this is something that my high school coach told me when I first started. I asked him, "What is something you wish you would have done?" Which is kind of one of my favorite questions to ask coaches.
Yeah.
Maybe something that you would like to do over, if you could. What's something you wish you would have done? And he said he wishes he would have spent more time or give more attention to guys 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 on the roster. He said so much of his time was wrapped up in the starting five or the top seven. And I think he's so right on the money. And I think that's kind of what John Wooden was talking about. He's used the word friendship, but doing things for and appreciating, celebrating, connecting with those guys that don't score points for you, that don't get a lot of playing time, that are low maintenance, that if you're not intentional, it's really easy to not pay attention to them. Like, I think that's a reminder for me. That's what I took from that quote, besides just the friendship part, is it's not special to give and invest a lot in your best players. You're going to do that. But what's special to me is, I think, being intentional enough to remember those other guys.
Yeah, I've always told my players, going back to my first year as a head coach, is, you know, I hope you understand that I don't see this as a 4-year relationship. I want it to be a 40-year relationship. Now, that relationship is going to evolve and change. The relationship that we have now is going to be much different than the one that we have 10 years from now and 20 years from now. You know, but I really think that in today's day and age, you cannot just focus on your top five, your top seven. You have to make sure that, and I think it's just if you're going to do something for one kid in the program, you need to do it for every kid in the program. If you are going to, you know, it's just taking care of everybody around you the way that people should be taken care of. And yeah, I wasn't perfect at it, you know, by any stretch of the imagination, but doggone it, I tried. I did my best to, whenever you're moving a kid up and down, and I, you know, again, lesson learned, you never move a kid up and then move them back down again. Once you move them up, you don't move them back down again. That's my opinion. Yeah. And you know, yeah, just different things like that. But you're there. You are not their friend as a coach, but you need to build a positive relationship with them so that hopefully in X amount of time, friendship will ensue as they become adults and they start moving into this world and they start sharing their life with you, you know, so forth and so on. That's what I think of when you're going down that line, Matt.
Yeah, no, I like that. I think you hit on something right there with even, and this is maybe like just a specific thing, but it's something I struggled with. I think all coaches do, is moving players up and down what teams you have them on. And I've always tried to, or thought, like, I want to do the very, very best for that player. But I over the years, but the idea of, if you're an underclassman and you're on varsity, you have to play. You have to get meaningful playing time, or else I'm not going to have you on there. So what I've done, probably the last 4 or 5 years, is start them lower than sometimes they want.
Yeah.
Or at least where I think they could be. Mm-hmm. But like, to start them out on JV Red with the idea of that's their team.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and at times they could practice, possibility to move up, but what I can remember one kid, I had played both, literally played both teams. And sometimes he'd get some varsity minutes, sometimes some JV 1 minutes. And after the season, I asked him how that went. And he said, "Coach, I never felt like I actually had a team. I was actually on a team. But here I'm trying to do," and he wasn't happy, and the family wasn't happy the whole year.
Yeah.
And I thought, here I'm trying to do what I think is best, or what they want, but it's not good for them. Like, I think a kid has to know what team they're on, where they're going to invest their time, and who, like, what coach they're with. But then, like, to your point, you can always pull them up.
Yeah.
But to either juggle them back and forth constantly, or to tell them they're on both, or to start and move down, I think those are you're going to have a negative outcome. But that's some one of those things that you unfortunately, unless you get have somebody tell you or give you that advice, you kind of fail and make mistakes and you kind of want to go back over the years, and you have all those players that you like to apologize to for, "I didn't know it, I didn't know."
Yeah.
Then, but that's one of those areas.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's one area where I grew at. And always, you know, I always tried to, you know, if this were me, how would this make me feel? I really did try to have that perspective, because, you know, as much as I'm a legend in my own mind, that's more on a Nerf hoop than it is on the 10-foot hoop with other people out there with me. You know, I wasn't very good. And, you know, so I, to a degree, understood what a lot of those kids were going, you know, those 7, 8, 9 kids. And, yeah. And so I've always tried to keep that in mind as I make decisions. Now, again, like any coach, it was always, what do I have to do that is best for the team? Just like I'm sure you've been there, Matt, where you've played players that maybe you didn't personally have the strongest relationship with, and you've had to sit players that you want your son or daughter to be like, you know, and that's just the natural part of the process. But I think there's that evolution. There's that thing that you learn. And like you said, a lot of it is just trial and error and collecting those scars and figuring those things out. So definitely agree with you there.
And I think, too, the way that you frame playing time, the way that you talk about development with your entire program, like, so take your parent meeting or the first time that you're talking with your players, setting the vision, setting the tone. I think those honest conversations about how playing time is, how you get that, you know, like how it's given out, and what our goal is every Tuesday and Friday night, which is to win, and we're not going to apologize for that.
Mm-hmm.
But then how every player will be developed every single day with the skill work that we do, but then also try to help them to see the fact that relationship doesn't equate to more or less playing time. So the more that I love a kid or appreciate them as a person or the teammate that they are, or how they lift our culture up, that doesn't automatically mean that they're going to play more. And on the flip side, if they're not playing, that doesn't mean that I love those kids more that are, or that I love or dislike the ones that I'm not playing. Because Shaka Smart had a great question that he asked players, is, does our relationship depend on your playing time?
Yep.
I think we have to help them see and open their eyes, like, oh, you know what? Like, I don't know if I've ever thought about that before. And sometimes looking back, because it's so easy as a parent, now that my son's gone through select ball and kind of finished with that, sitting there wondering why he's not playing, and all of a sudden think that thought popping in my head, I wonder if this guy doesn't like him for some reason. And then I have to stop myself and like, no, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Like you actually, I know why he's not playing. I got to zoom out and see, you know, the practices I've watched or in this game, he's not executing or competing or going to help us win right now. But that's like, I don't, to expect parents to get that on their own if they've never played or they haven't been a coach, I don't think we can do that. So the way that we frame it and the way we try to bring them alongside. And then all like throughout the year, like we talked about before, valuing all of those guys and showing them how they're valued and why, just no matter what role they're playing. Man, I just think there is a way to do it. You're never going to make everybody happy. And if you're trying to please everybody, then that's a losing battle and you're going to compromise. But if they know what the standards are and what our goal is every night, but you can show them and prove to them that they will all get better and they will all improve. And then what playing time actually means. Mm-hmm. I think you can help them get on board with the vision. And maybe over the course of the year, you have less parent meetings on playing time.
Yeah. Yeah. Matt, when was your first a pen and a napkin moment? When do you remember the first time you started scratching some stuff out on paper or a napkin or something like that?
Man, that's a good question too. Mm-hmm. So I always loved. I viewed basketball as from a player's lens for a long time. I loved the skill work part of it. The X's and O's, whatever the coach wanted us to do, I would do it. So like Coach Bliss was big into four-man flex. And so I got big into that. And it's kind of funny, Coach Drew and those guys had called me Coach Stamen. At the time I thought maybe they were joking, you know, like almost, you know, almost like sarcastic. Like, are they making fun of me? You know, I don't know. But no, I think it was because I viewed the game. I was a player, but I think I had a good IQ for it. And it really was my first job at Neiman Forest. I was just, I was 24, 5. I was a varsity assistant for Jeff Clarkson. And I was just trying to learn how does school basketball work as a coach? And he was also very established and kind of did things his way. And which was good. And so I learned a little bit about that. And then at McKinney with Wes Watson, that he was the one that really got me kind of to your question. My first year there, we had a really good senior group and he wanted me to offensively kind of steer the ship. He wanted to be kind of the way a lot of staffs have gone, where one guy will take the defense, one guy will take the offense, kind of the football model. I was so impressed at the time with his humility as a coach to allow this 25-year-old the offense and him to see that, like, he could trust me with that, but then we could divide and conquer a little bit more. So I really got into the Kansas motion, all screen motion at the time. And it was when I learned that there were things out there like coaching packets. Like, I didn't even know that stuff existed. Like, you could go to clinics and you could learn from what other coaches are doing and people are freely sharing ideas. So we did that. And then the next year it was dribble drive motion. And cause Calipari had made it really big at Memphis, and I didn't even know who Vance Wahlberg was at the time, but I got that two game packet from about Memphis. Mm-hmm. And it was, I brought it to Coach Watson. I was like, Coach, this is it. Like, this is what we need to do. Let me put this in. And that started getting me into fast. Mm-hmm. And the idea that with this style of play, we're going to shoot more threes. We're going to shoot less twos and we're going to shoot our inside the arc twos. And then we're going to shoot a lot of layups and we're going to increase our pace. And Coach Watson wanted to press. So there's this legendary coach around here, Kenny Hoffpower, that had this this pressing package. Uh-huh. And read or rotate that we would press. And so those two combined, we went from averaging 55 points a game to 68 and making 271 threes. At the time, I thought, no one had ever made 271 threes before. I thought it was the most threes I'd ever heard of in a season. Mm-hmm. And it was just the joy, mm-hmm, and the fun of that style of play. And then I got, after a few years came to Faith and I wanted to go even farther with that. So to a point where we've made 432 threes in a year. And so that 271, like, oh man, that was nothing. That got our worst shooting years here. We've done it. But you kind of, it was the love of learning new ideas and styles, terminology, like you said, scribbling things down. So now, you know, 16 years into it, and you start to gain a little more focus on what you're looking for. Yeah, and I forget what, I think it was Coach Slaw from Cornell.
Oh, Dave, yeah, having, you bet.
Yeah, I talked about having notebooks just all over the house, because if he sees something or if he thinks about something, he wants to be able to get it down really quick. I like that idea.
Mm-hmm. Coaches are absolutely loving our taking over a new program booklet. As many of you know, I spent 2 years outside of coaching, and during that time, I hung a note card in my workspace at school that said, "Strip the house down to the studs." I took that time to really rethink and reorganize my thoughts on what it takes to run a transformational program. As I prepared for the possibility of coaching again, I organized these thoughts into this 96-page booklet. How much do I trust this booklet? I used this booklet as I went on interviews to help sell myself and my vision for what my new program would look like. If I'm using it to sell myself, why wouldn't I recommend it to you, my listeners? This booklet will help you look at any part of your program, no matter what stage you're at in your program, and help improve it in some way. It's all yours for only $15, which includes shipping and handling. For more information, email me at apenandanapkin@gmail.com. How are you guys developing so many great shooters, Matt?
A lot of it has to come from PGC Shooting College. I directed a bunch of those and opened my eyes to how little form really has to do with it. I don't have any proof of this, but I think it's 90-10. I think it's 90% what you think and how you train, and it's 10% the actual form that you have. And so getting away as a coach from trying to change players' shots to let's get you shooting and training faster, and then let's talk about what you think about when you shoot. And I don't know if I got this from anywhere, but it's just kind of been a realization over the years of, I think how you discuss shooting with your program is directly related to the culture that you actually have. Because the way that coaches talk about shot selection, I think that's a direct correlation to the type of culture that, whether they say it or not, I don't care what the acronym is or what the words are, that is the direction that you're taking your team.
Yeah.
And so that's been the biggest shift, is getting the guys to realize why they're missing. They're missing because of two reasons. They practice too slow, and they practice without pressure. So practicing too slow, we need to figure out ways in every drill, every game that we shoot, for the most part, not every, I don't like absolutes, but for a lot of our drills, we need to shoot faster. Well, when you shoot faster, the crazy thing is your form cleans up quite a bit, but early on, you miss more shots.
Yeah.
So then, if you want them to shoot faster, we've got to talk about what misses mean. And misses mean nothing. You have to get them past the idea of, if I miss a shot, it's bad, or if I make a shot, it's good. After it leaves your hands, it's done. Like, it's what Doug Novak said. It's not that you have to make the shot, but it's that you have to take it. Mm-hmm. If there's one thing that I would say could change the type of shooting team that you have, it's that idea. Is, do your players think that they're allowed to shoot when they're open? And do they know that they're allowed to miss? Because if there's pressure on that shot, mm-hmm, of missing it, you're going to get less confident, more scared, and reluctant shooters. To me, there's enough pressure already on the shot. I've never met a kid that wants to miss. I've never met a player.
Exactly.
But I think we treat them like that.
Yeah.
Like, if they miss, that, how dare you? How can you suck so bad? Why don't you care more? But like, that's not it. The kids don't want to miss. They want to make shots. So I have to do everything that I can to promote and create an environment that'll help them to make more shots. So that's all within how they train. And then it's the pressure part.
Mm-hmm.
If I think that they're just going to shoot fast, or, hey, guys, make sure, you know, in a game, there's going to be a lot of pressure. Make sure you put that on yourself. Well, okay, like on their own, they're not going to do that. So most of our shooting isn't volume or form. It's shooting games.
Yeah.
Because I need them shooting fast. So there has to be a time component to yep. it.
Gotta be and then I need them shooting.
Yeah. And I need them shooting with pressure. So there has to be an inner rose or a total score or something. And it all has to be charted. But charting to me isn't writing it down, because it's me. I always am very sympathetic to the coaches that don't have six assistants in the gym with them or a bunch of managers. It's me, my assistant coach some days, and 30 to 35 kids. So we have 43 minutes a day to squeeze every ounce of training out of that. So one, we have to be incredibly organized. We have to move fast. I have to coach in sound bites. And we have to put pressure on them so that, and I heard this the other, Mark Cassio said this the other day. He's like, there's really nothing that we can do in practice to truly simulate the pressure from a game.
Yeah.
But we have to try to get as close to that as possible. And I think that's when kids have, for whatever reason, come to faith and they start training with us, that's been the biggest thing to them is, the difference is how we train, how fast we, and how much we get done. But the shooting games that ultimately lead to them getting to make the choice, I need to practice more on my own, or you know what, like I'm in a really good place. And then in a game, instead of me guessing as to a kid will make shots because he's missed a few, I can let him know, like, you've missed four in a row. What's about to happen? He should say, I'm about to get hot.
Yep.
Because our motto is shoot to get hot and shoot to stay hot. So if that's our motto, then they got to go through misses to get to those makes. And I think that's where we've been able to have some of those incredible performances is my only thing is next and keep shooting. And so players, going back to the question of would I want to play for me? I think now with the type, like the way that we approach shooting, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would tell my players, you know, they're not all going in, but the next one is. And that's the attitude you have to have as a shooter is, you know, and as a coach, don't you think, Matt, it's really, really important if you want shooters to shoot, if they miss a couple of shots, you can't start talking to them too much. I mean,
right.
And maybe that's wrong. I don't know, but it's the way I've always thought. Because, you know, I referred to my own skills, which were limited at best, but I could shoot. I could really, really shoot the ball. And, you know, if I missed a shot, I was just like, I'm just going to keep shooting. I'm just going to keep shooting. I trust myself. And when you try to overcoach that at times, as a coach, or you're, you know, now again, there's situation score. You're up two with a minute left and there's 25 seconds on the shot clock and you crank one from 30 feet. Well, then we got to have a discussion then, but the regular flow of the game, you've got to allow your kids to feel confident in what they're doing, how they're going to shoot it, their shot selection. You got to trust their shot selection and you got to believe in them. And when you start over coaching shot selection with really good shooters, you're just limiting them too much. You know, it's a conversation that I had this weekend with a buddy of mine here in Nebraska. He's got three or four kids that can really, really shoot it. And sometimes they take some bad shots, but you've got to kind of live with that. And how do you coach them into saying, okay, you could take that shot eight seconds into the shot clock, and but if you're patient in 14 seconds, in just six more seconds, you're going to get a great look instead of an okay look, you know, and that's the art of coaching that you've got to go through as well. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure those are conversations you've had with your kids.
Coach, I love that you brought up shot selection. It's something I'm really passionate about. I think I think because going back to shot selection is culture. Yep. Day one has to be culture. Culture doesn't start when the season starts. Culture is day one of school, and it goes all the way through until the last day of school, but then extends into the summer, depending on what you do. And because it's not what you do, but how you do what you do, right? And so if culture is day one, shot selection has to be day one. You have to have a common language about shot selection that everybody is on board with. Everybody knows it's clear, and it can be reminded. You can be reminded quickly. And once you set up what shot select, your scale, whatever it is, early, then you're coaching that every day in small-sided games, every practice, giving them reminders. But with a scale, in my opinion, you can, with a scale, you can take the emotion out of it. Because to me, shot selection is one of the things that coaches get the most mad about, but and especially in games. But if you're getting mad about it in games or having to remind kids about it in games, maybe not remind, but like get on to them or ask them why they're taking bad shots, or that, or tell them, hey, only good shots right now. Hey, guys, we need great shots. Those are okay shots. See, all that stuff is really vague. And little Timmy's going to be on the bench, and he's going to go, well, he's not talking to me. I step my double step back. I can shoot that whenever I want, right? Like if you're yelling about shot selection in a game or trying to teach it, man, you're in trouble. Yeah. You got to go back in time, get a time machine, go back and fix it. Because it has to be day one. And in my opinion, it is the number one reason why you win or lose games. Mm-hmm. There's all these other stats that are really good. You can have, like in the Grinnell system, there's five things that they try to achieve every game to win. And I love that. There's other coaches, they have three things for whatever it is. But shot selection, if you've ever lost a game by 8 points or less, which we all have,
yep,
that's just shot selection. It's one bad shot a quarter that you could have changed your mind on. You could have controlled because you can block out really well, but sometimes there's a bad bounce. Sometimes the bigger dude just wins. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But shot selection is under our control for the most part. And I think that's something where we run a free flowing system where I don't call plays on live ball when it's a live ball. And they are out there creating for themselves and deciding who shoots and who doesn't. We better have an organized way of discussing shot selection. And then when a mistake inevitably happens because they're high school kids, they're teenagers, instead of being mad, I ask them, hey, Johnny, rate that shot. Well, coach, you know what? That's a six. Yeah, Johnny, it was a six. Why do you think you shot that? Like, why did you have to shoot the six? Well, I just, you know, coach, the ball hasn't been coming to me. Oh, okay. So you're not trusting your teammates right now or the action. Yeah, coach, I just think I haven't touched it in a while. Like, I get that. Here's what I want you to do. The next day, ball, we're going to run something for you, Johnny, to get you a ball in a dangerous spot. But I need you to trust your teammates. Trust your action. I'll talk to those guys about moving it. But like this whole conversation that I've had, I've been able to, one, not take his confidence away, not destroy our relationship, find out really what he's thinking, and think about it. You know what? Johnny's our best player. And the last few possessions down, the ball hasn't made its way to him. Not that those guys are being selfish. It's because I don't believe that ball movement leads to better shots. I believe that if we can find the best shot as fast as possible against retreating defense off of zero passes, one pass, maybe two, that's better than what we could get 5, 6, 7, 8 passes or running a bunch of action. Yep. But that's just my personal belief. It's kind of what Joe Crispin talked about. He said he's got personal constraints that or belief systems that he has that he can't break. And because of that, he views the game from a certain way. Mm-hmm. And so those are one of my constraints is that more passes does not equal better shots.
Yeah.
And that we, because of that though, there is a chance that if Johnny's our best scorer, we could go a few possessions. So what I got to do on a dead ball is that's when I can take a little bit more control, orchestrate, hey, we're going to be in four, which is let's just get our best player to the right elbow, give him space and let him turn and go play. Mm-hmm. But going all the way back to why shot selection is so important, what typically happens is, hey, that's a crap shot. Like, you need to stop being selfish and you need to get on board with what we're doing as a team. But that's not it, and that's damaging. And, or sometimes a player thinks that it's the best shot, but he doesn't realize that the closeout was too close. And I say, you know what, Johnny, I appreciate you think it's a seven. And I want you shooting sevens, man. But it's a wide open jump shot within your range. But in my opinion, that's a six.
Yeah.
If it's a six, what could you do, Johnny? Oh, you know what? I could lift and I could attack. I'm like, you're right on the money, because you had a double gap to your right where you could probably get all the way to the rim, or you got a great mid-range if you want, or you could play with your teammate. But to me, if this is a partnership, if it's a player-led team, I can't just decide all of a sudden when I become dictator and tell them everything they can and can't do. But golly, coach, like, that's hard.
Yep.
But it's a struggle every day. And I feel like we as coaches damage confidence way more than we build into it.
Mm-hmm. Matt, let's go home on this. You've built a heck of a culture there. You put up great things, you know, your 10-minute meetings in the preseason, different things, you know, just, you know, your alumni weekend, legacy letters, so many different things. You know, how are you able to fit all this in and also get accomplished what you need to get accomplished on the floor? I mean, how are you building that transformational culture there at Grapevine?
You know, what's funny is I don't think that I'm a very organized person. But my wife has made comments that I am. And so I trust her judgment. I think I'm always trying to, like, Ryan Holiday is one of my favorite people to listen to. Stillness is the Key is a great book. But he talks a lot about the Stoics and some of the habits that they've had for success. So I don't think I'm very organized, but I am blessed with the job that I have, which gives me time. Mm-hmm. Because you're right on the money. The social media, I run our account at GFCS MBB. Uh-huh. Those graphics take a lot of time. Remembering the systems in place and the stuff that needs to be done. Like, there's a theme every day for our workouts. There's a graphic every day. There's alumni game. There's legacy letters. There's shooting games that we play that give out magnets. Like, all these things, it's culture. And if culture is our number one job, then that's the stuff that I need to spend a lot of time on. And so, but I have time throughout the day that I get to do that and the podcast and everything. So I'm thankful to Faith for giving me a job with the schedule where I can do all those things. But it also goes to style of play. Simplicity is sophistication.
Yep.
I think that what we do at Faith with our style of play is easy, but are simple. But because of that, we're able to get deep into it. So we're not jack of all trades, master of none. We're trying to be really, really good at a few things. Because of that, I don't have to spend a ton of time watching film, practice planning, what new skills or drills. I love learning new things, but we know who we are, and we have, and I think the word is identity. Mm-hmm. Because of our identity, I can focus on the number one thing, which is culture. I'm thankful to be at a place where basketball isn't the number one thing for these kids. Hopefully it's their faith, then it's their family, then it's academics, and basketball and all the other stuff hopefully is fourth. So if it's fourth, then I have to have them, they have to want to come to the gym or to get to come to the gym. Yeah. So because of that, it has to be fun.
Yep.
So I have a color wheel, a spin wheel, that on Fun Fridays, I bring it out with all of our shooting games, and they get to spin the wheel to choose the shooting games. I could easily just say, hey, today we're going to do this, this, and this, and they'd be fine with it because most players are pleasers
Yep.
and it's shooting games. But all I do is I bring out that stupid pinwheel, and I get to randomly choose somebody, or it's somebody that, hey, who would like to do it? And 30 hands shoot up, and they get to spin the wheel, and it clicks onto one of their games. All of the games are what I want, but they have this choice in it, and it's fun. The smile on their face. If I can just spend enough time every day trying to be creative to learn new ways, like we're about to go in a tournament at a tournament. And I saw on social media the other day, this team, coach, I'm going to try it out. They split the team into two, and this is done at the hotel because hotel, a lot of times it's wasted time. You know, we want them to rest. We got to go eat and stuff, but I don't typically have a ton planned at these tournaments, especially when we're staying at a hotel. But there's culture that could be created there even more or fun. So there's this sheet that they hold up, and two coaches are holding the sheet. They're on chairs, and two players hide behind. And it's 3-2-1, and the sheet drops, and the guys have to visually see each other, and it's the first person to see the name, say the name out loud. And it's funny, like they see the guy, but they go, and they pause, and the other guy says the name, and they lose. I've never seen that before, but we're going to try it. Like, we could watch film, we could go over stats, we could do this and that, but coach, that's fun. And I think that those culture things lead to winning. And it's what Ted Lasso said, or the reporter said in season three. It's the thousand little things that you do every day. So, but to answer your question, I guess I'm organized, and my wife says that I am, but I have a lot of time.
Who are some of the people that have really influenced your cultural style? Yeah, I mean, you talked about PGC and all the guys that are there. Anybody else outside of there that is has really given you a lot to go on, a lot of good ideas, a lot of inspiration to build the things that you've been able to build?
That's a good question. Well, style of play, Mark Cassio, Doug Novak, they're really big right there. PGC, from a culture and training or practice standpoint, I think if you would come to a faith workout, it would feel like a PGC practice or shooting college. I think I think you have to be curious. Another Ted Lasso thing. He kind of made a comment about one of the older guy that's kind of the villain in it. He's the owner of the other club,
Oh yeah,
and he
yep.
just says, "I just don't think you're a very curious person." And I think I'm curious. I want to know, is there a way to make this more fun, and in a way then also like, okay, you asked who is an influence. Twitter is an influence. The guys at Mike or Chris Oliver, the guys at Basketball Immersion, Alex Sharama. What's the guy that did the false skills, not false skills. And what is it called? Mike McCormick? Brian McCormick. Sorry, man. Edit all that out. Brian McCormick and, you know, false skills and all that, like X or social media, man, follow those people and then understand that, like, not everything has to fit. You don't have to do everything that people say. Like, there's so many great one-liners, and probably you feel this way too, or ideas from the podcast, but you can't do it all. And so you know yourself, you're curious. And then I think the more that you can focus on fun, and that would be like, if one thing that my former players in faith, if they came back now, they would probably be like, it just seems like it's a lot more fun than when I was a serious coach. And that doesn't mean that you don't want to win. And actually, I would think that you kind of get more out of your guys when you have that. That's kind of my advice or where I learn things from.
Mm-hmm. Great stuff, Matt. If folks want to know more about you, they want to know more about your program, they want to know more about the Jamoti podcast, how can they find out about it?
Yeah, I think just emailing me is really good. And it's saman.matt@gmail.com. And then yeah, I'm on social media and the podcast is at Jamoti Podcast. I think I'm Matt_Saman on X and Instagram, but I do my very, very best to reach out to people when they reach out to me. Love talking hoops, and I think the fun thing about getting to do this is the sharing of ideas and not holding on to things yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, it has been awesome talking to you for the second time now and putting this all together. It's just so many good things. I've got a page full of notes here. You know, just don't fake it, face it. I love that. Would you want to play for
and
yourself?
I want to give credit. Can I give credit real quick? Because I said it when I passed. But Josh Stewart is the coach that that told me that. And Josh is incredible. And if anybody wants to listen to just a great episode and learn a lot about culture, his is episode 213, Josh Stewart. He coached in Montana on an Indian reservation. But I don't know if I've ever met a more transformational coach than him. Mm-hmm. And he was the one that told me that it's that fake it till you make it is damaging and that we should teach kids to face it. And man, so like I give him the credit for that. And then also, I also want to just celebrate you for doing this and just let everybody get excited. Your episode will be coming out. Season 7 just started this week and your episode will be coming out. And it was really fun to get to know you and have you on and just really appreciate you, man.
Well, thanks, Matt. I appreciate you. You know, we had a good time. I had a good time with being on yours. I hope you've enjoyed being on A Pen and a Napkin here.
Yeah, this was awesome. Always cool to be on the other side of it and humbled that you'd ask me to come on.
Well, yeah, that's, you know, like when I was on yours, I'm like, I'm always asking the questions. You ask me the questions. I don't want to think too much right now. You know? So that is the fun part about being on somebody else's, but, great stuff here. Matt, thanks so much for your time here today. If you could hold the line just for a minute, Matt Saman, again, boys basketball coach, Grapevine Faith High School in Texas, and check out his pod. It's really, really good. The Jamoti pod, just a matter of doing it. And it's really, really good stuff that Matt does there. Speaking of good stuff, Cosec Chiropractic does great stuff for you. If you need a little adjustment, don't hesitate to reach out to Dr. Kevin or Dr. Heidi. Like I said, follow us on Twitter at A Pen and a Napkin. Download, rate, and review this. Of course, email me, apenandanapkin@gmail.com for any questions, comments, suggestions, or ideas. I want to thank Matt Saman for his time here. You know, he's on his holiday break and he could be doing a lot of other things and he decides to come on A Pen and a Napkin. So that is greatly, greatly appreciated. Coaches, as always, let's be sure to learn our craft.